Black Talk Radio Network is made possible in part with help from the Black Talk Media Project, a North Carolina-based nonprofit engaged in the production and distribution of independent digital black media. Find out more by going to blacktalkradionetwork.com or blacktalkmediaproject.org and look for the menu tab, Crowdfunding Black Media. Black Talk Media Project, helping to provide you with new black media for the new millennium. Opinions expressed by callers, guests, and hosts do not necessarily reflect those of the Black Talk Radio Network and Black Talk Media Project. Black Talk Radio is new black media for the new millennium. Tuned in to Black Talk Radio News. My name is Scotty Reed, and I'm broadcasting from behind the enemy lines that I call USA Inc. It is a Friday afternoon. It's another hot day here in North Carolina. Today's date is September the 30th in the year that they call 2016. Welcome to this live broadcast today here on Black Talk Radio Network, providing you with new black media for the new millennium. Now, let's get into what we will be discussing today. We will have a guest, hopefully. We had to push the time back, but hopefully we will connect with Professor Johanna Fernandez, who I have interviewed before in relation to political prisoners. She's a very strong political prisoner advocate, as well as an abolitionist. She is a self-identified abolitionist. Who recognized that slavery was never abolished in the United States. She teaches at the City University of New York. She is a native New Yorker and received a PhD in history from Columbia University and has a BA in literature and American civilization from Brown University. She teaches 21st century U.S. history, the history of social movements, the political economy of American cities, and African American history. Now, we want to talk to her today about the plight of the Bronx 120, an interview we did with the mother of one of the victims. The Bronx 120 refers to the young men who were the targets of a massive raid in New York City in trying to come up with some RICO charges and conspiracy charges and trying to get these young men for things that they had already been punished for. And so acting like they running some kind of mob crime syndicate up there. So we want to get an update from her about that. Also want to get her thoughts on the historic national prison strikes against prison slavery, which has still yet to appear as a news story in your corporate media news outlets. Still have not seen one. Doesn't mean they haven't, but I'm sure if they did, I would have heard about it. Somebody would have told me, because I've been asking, where are the news reports on this historical? This is U.S. history being made with this strike that's going on in on the prison plantations across the nation. A massive strike against prison slavery. So you would think that would be newsworthy. It's not newsworthy to a number of outlets, and you have to ask yourself why. We also want to get a update from her about political prisoner Mumia Abu-Jamal. Not only are people trying to help him attain his freedom after successfully getting him off of death row, but he also suffers from Hep C which there is a cure for Hep C. That I think it has something like a 90% plus cure rate, and they won't give it to him. He's been suing for the cure for Hep C, which could also open up the door to other prisoners getting access to this life-saving medicine. All right, so that's what's on tap for today. If you have any questions, comments, observations you would like to share, the telephone number for the conference line is 641-715-3660. The participant code is 549-032-POUND. Just hit *6 and 1. That'll signal me. I will bring you on air. You can also use the web-based flash phone. Make a free call. Just got to have a pair of headsets with a mic. And you can also call us on the studio line. Let me open up the studio line because I don't think it's open right now. It is open, and that telephone number is 704-951-5030. Again, that is 704-951-5030. We will be talking to the professor here in just a bit. So let me go ahead and cue that up. Some of the news that I want to discuss after we talk to Professor Johanna Fernandez. The UN, I don't know if y'all saw this come out yesterday, but the UN said, a UN panel says that the United States owes black people reparations for a history of racial terrorism. And this is something I have talked about in the past. And even recently, I think I might have had a conversation with Dave on Tando Radio Show about that. Let me see. We got a call coming in. Let me see who do we have here. Area code 850. You're on Black Talk Radio News. Who do we have on the line?
This is Ibram Kendi.
This is who?
Ibram Kendi.
Okay. Are we scheduled? Are you scheduled to speak with us today?
Yeah, 4 p.m. Eastern Standard.
And I'm sorry. You know what, sir? There has been a mix-up in scheduling. I do recall. So,
we can just reschedule. It's no problem.
Is that okay, sir? I had to get with my assistant, but there was a mix-up in scheduling because we're supposed to talk to another. But I do remember you, so I will email you, and I will get back to you and get you scheduled as soon as possible for the next broadcast.
Okay, sounds great.
All right, thank you.
All right, thank you. Bye-bye.
Okay, sorry about that. I was wondering why we had a call coming in. I'm going to have to tighten up our scheduling. I do recall that being scheduled for today, but it slipped my mind when we set up this other interview because it was kind of time sensitive as it relates to the NYC Rays, the Bronx 120, Mumia, and his Hep C treatment. So, but getting back to the UN panel, this UN panel, a lot of people don't know because this wasn't on your corporate news channels, but you had a UN panel, a delegation that came here to the United States and was going to different cities, taking testimony from African-descended people, black Americans, whatever label you want to call them. They took testimony. They was taking testimony and evidence on the racial terrorism that happens here in the United States. All of it is connected to 21st century slavery and human trafficking. But this UN panel says that they're owed reparations because of racial terrorism. And that's what I have said in the past about the reparations movement. Number one, you're ignoring the current ongoing slavery that is happening on the prison plantations, and number two, you're ignoring the fact that every black person on this continent was not brought here or did not come here on a slave ship. There were plenty of free black people in the colonies and, of course, in, you know, the early creation of this country, and they suffered racial terrorism. racism, and I remember the slave codes were passed, and that was one of the pieces of legislation, colonial pieces of legislation, that stripped free black citizens of their rights and what have you. So yeah, I felt like reparations should not just be tied to those who suffered from or the descendants of enslaved Africans, but also for the racial terrorism that is ongoing, I might add. So let's go ahead and see if we can get Sister Jonina, excuse me, not Jonina, Johanna on. And we'll talk about these topics for today.
Hello.
Hello, Sister Johanna.
Yes.
Yes, this is Scotty Reed, Black Talk Radio News. You may not remember, but I actually have spoken to you before with when we were producing Political Prisoner Radio with Sister Remigio.
I remember.
Yes, yeah, so it was a surprise that one of our interns is actually knows you up there in New York. And so when he set this up, I wasn't aware of who he was speaking of at first because he didn't use your last name. But when I looked it up, I was like, oh, yes, I've spoken to her before concerning political prisoners. So it's great to have you back on the network. How's your day thus far?
Oh, good. I was just teaching at Hunter College, and I'm doing well. Thank you. And thank you so much for your work on the radio. Very important.
Oh, you're welcome. You're welcome. I feel like it's my calling right now. You know, some people say they get a calling to become preachers. I had a calling to become a radio engineer and set up a platform because it is much needed with the disappearance of so much independent black media and black voices in terrestrial radio and what have you. So I do feel like the work we do is important, and thank you for recognizing that. So, I do believe one of the things I want to ask you, Tag, and I'm not going to use his real name. He doesn't want me to use his real name, but Tag described you, said that you self-describe as an abolitionist. Is that correct?
Absolutely. Is correct.
And what does abolition, when we say that, you know, most people think to the 1800s, and they might be thinking a different kind of abolitionist, as you do have a group of abolitionists out of New York calling themselves new abolitionists, but they're focusing on the human trafficking and sex slavery that's already illegal. They're not recognizing that slavery was never abolished. So are we speaking on the same vein in that you are abolitionist, meaning that slavery was never abolished and preserved by the 13th Amendment exception clause, and you want to see slavery abolished once and for all in this country?
Right, absolutely. The new abolitionists are very interested in that clause in the 13th Amendment that allowed slavery in prisons, and abolitionists today are interested in abolishing prisons altogether. We believe that the conditions of society, economic inequality, political and social inequality, are directly connected to the proliferation of crime in predominantly poor African American and Latino communities. And ultimately, the question of incarceration is important because it raises questions about what kind of society we want to live in. Do we want to live in a society that throws away individuals in prisons, or do we want to create a society that abolishes crime altogether, the need for crime, a particular kind of crime that is targeted in this society? Because as we know, our government and the people who work on Wall Street are involved in criminal activity on a mass an organized scale all the time, but they are not the people who end up in prison.
No,
it's
they just
the
end
at
up
the bottom of society and the poor.
Yeah, they just end up paying a fine, as I saw a news headline today that was saying about three or four big banks, and I think these are might even be international banks, are set to pay huge fines to the United States government. And it just reminds me when Wachovia, before it was bought out by Wells Fargo, they got busted laundering drug money. And they no one was criminally prosecuted. They just signed an agreement admitting no wrongdoing and just, you know, paying the fine.
Absolutely, and this is what we see day in and day out in American society. There's the criminal activity that large banks engage in. There is the crime perpetrated by Wall Street bigwigs who pretty much devastated and destroyed the American economy the last time around during the recession of 2008. I think it's important to mention that it was critical resistance and the conference it had in the 1990s on the West Coast that raised the issue of abolition of prisoners, abolition of prisons, and essentially took the position, which I think quite a number of activists, historians, sociologists to hold on to, which is that imprisonment is about controlling the people at the bottom of society. Imprisonment is about social and economic control, but also political repression. And that really gets us to the crisis of political imprisonment in the United States and the fact that quite a number of activists from the era of the 1960s and 70s are behind bars today. And with the criminalization and ideology of law and order and the racialization of crime that has always been part of American society but was deepened in the 1960s to criminalize black activists and those involved in urban rebellions, that policy of law and order was deployed against the majority of people of color and the African American community in particular as a punishment for the rebellion of the descendants of slaves during the civil rights and black power movement. And so, you know, we know that the level of incarceration in this nation increased exponentially. In 1970, there were approximately 200 and some odd thousand people, 200,000 people or more in prison, and today we have 2.3 people behind bars, the majority of them African-American, Latino, despite the fact that the level of crime has pretty much remained the same over this period.
Yes, ma'am. Well, that is a good segue to one of the things that we wanted to talk to you today about. We wanted to talk to you about the Bronx 120. We also wanted to get an update on Mumia Abu-Jamal's case, specifically his case trying to obtain Hep C treatment, which there is a cure now, and they want to deny it to prisoners, and particularly a person like Mumia Abu-Jamal. We know our political prisoners, they want them dead. So obviously they're not going to give them any life-saving medicine or any kind of medicine that's going to improve their quality of life. So let's start with the Bronx 120. We had actually interviewed a mother whose son was caught up in that massive raid that occurred in New York City earlier this year. For those who may not have heard of that, could you give them a brief overview of what we're talking about?
Yes. So on April 27th of this year, in the Williamsburg section of the Bronx, and also in the East Chester projects that are adjacent or part of the Williamsburg section of the Bronx, an alphabet soup of local, state, and national police agencies, including the FBI, ICE, the NYPD, and quite a number of other outfits, pretty much attacked this Bronx neighborhood in the middle of the night and arrested 70 young people. The average age of the people they arrested was 24. And they indicted 120, and in the process terrorized an African-American and Latino community, poor, and charged these people with federal laws of conspiracy for their alleged gang activity. So 70 people, the 70
indicted,
people were arrested.
120.
I'm sorry, I was trying to find something. I apologize. And so you were saying that about the 120. And just a quick note, didn't the authorities go after them on RICO charges, which is usually reserved for like mafia crime syndicates and whatnot?
Exactly. So the RICO law emerges, as we know, in the early 1970s to target the organized mafia. And this law, which is a federal law, is now being deployed against people in the Bronx, some of whom are probably involved in petty crime. But the reason why they're using the RICO law is because under the RICO law, they can be charged with conspiracy. What that means is that any kind of association, if you are right, friends with someone who has been charged, you too can be charged, mm-hmm. Whether or not there's any evidence that you participated in any kind of illegal activity. But this is really not about crime. Part of what has emerged and what people who study these cases understand is that the NYPD was seriously restrained when stop and frisk was declared unconstitutional.
Yes.
And part of what the NYPD has done subsequent to that decision, which made stop and frisk unconstitutional, is to redirect their repressive activities against people of color at the bottom of society through this ruse of clearing out the gangs in New York. What's outrageous is that we know that crime-related violence has gone down exponentially,
mm-hmm.
In New York and around the country, but specifically in New York since 2000. And here we have a gang bust of epic proportion involving 700 officers, police officers, and members of units like ICE and the FBI, that descended on this community in the middle of the night and terrorized it. And this would not happen in a white community, working class or middle class, in the United States. So this case is now under review. Many of the young people who were arrested and charged are going to be appearing before the court in October. And the community is mobilizing because many of the mothers who live in projects are now facing eviction and the loss of their housing in association with this gang bust.
Right.
Again, the gang bust is the largest in New York City history.
Yeah, one of those parents of one of the victims of this massive raid was Paula Clark, and we spoke to her earlier this month, on around September the 8th. We spoke with her, and she described when she came on, she described it as she thought it was terrorism. Hearing, you know, these explosions outside of her home and what have you, and then to have these men, you know, looking like military soldiers bust into her house and terrorized her and her young daughters, and the person they were looking for, one of her sons, was not even there, and was on parole and was living with his father, and the parole office had that information. So they did this shock and awe raid on her home, and she was able to capture it on her security cameras, pointing guns at them, forced her and her daughters to belly crawl towards the officers who had come into the home and what have you. So she, you know, definitely felt terrorized by all of that.
Well, I'm glad that you used the term shock and awe, because what happened in the Bronx on April 27th of this year is not unlike what we saw happening in Iraq, in Fallujah, when a group of 700 armed men in uniform threw all kinds of smoke bombs into buildings and into the homes of people to essentially get residents out of their apartments so that they could cherry pick and arrest mainly young men indiscriminately. And this happened in the middle of the night with everyone present, mothers, fathers, children, sisters. This is, in fact, an act of terror led by the state in the United States of America.
You know, I'm just thankful that no one was killed, because whenever you have these types of no-knock raids where they don't knock, they shock and awe you, break in. But we saw in Detroit little 7-year-old Ayanna Jones be killed in one of these type of no-knock raid situations. So I was just thankful no one was killed. But Ms. Clark definitely expressed how she felt, you know, like she was scared. I would be scared too, quite honestly, if something like that occurred to me. So where is the case now? The last time we had spoke to her, she said there was an attempt to get them competent representation, something about maybe a fundraiser. So have you heard anything about that?
Well, there is an attempt right now to get competent attorneys to represent the men. I do believe that many of the men and their families are not happy with the legal representation they have, because this is a pretty big case involving the federal, state, and municipal governments, and there's an enormous amount of pressure on attorneys to essentially work with the government to indict these young people. So we are in the process, and the activists and families, especially Sister Paula Clark, who's one of the mothers who's become an active advocate in support of these young people. So that's one of the struggles right now. They have a fundraiser, but we are having a meeting, probably the first large public meeting of its kind, to talk about the Eastchester 120 case and its meaning and consequences for city life here in New York. And that's happening this coming Wednesday, October 5th, and it's being held at the National Black Theater, which is on Fifth Avenue, just north of 125th Street. So the event is this Wednesday, October 5th, at the National Black Theater at 7 p.m. And we're asking people to join us to help raise awareness of this case, which, by the way, as you know, hasn't really been covered in the mainstream media.
No, it has
not. It's been buried.
Yes, it has. Yes, it has.
And we're combining a discussion of the Eastchester 120 with a discussion of Lumia's health suit. The title of the event is Survival Crimes, and it's a political forum and comic sketch. Immortal Technique, the hip-hop activist and revolutionary lyricist, is going to be there. Paula Clark, the mother, one of the mothers of the Eastchester 120, will be there. Bob Boyle, who's a National Lawyers Guild attorney and who represents Mumia, will speak. Pam Africa will be present of the MOVE organization to speak, as well as Niall Fort, who's a graduate student and young minister.
Mm-hmm. Well, as we transition to Mumia, I just had this thought, and I had it before when I first heard about this case. And you mentioned, you know, that stop and frisk was ruled unconstitutional by the courts. And I just simply looked at this as retaliation for that. Like petulant little children who are angry because they could no longer just stop and frisk black men without probable cause on the streets of New York. And that they just went back and regrouped. And, you know, how else can we terrorize the community? That's how I looked at it, Professor.
Absolutely. You've used the accurate words here. This was an act of retaliation on the part of the police in New York City to the ruling that established that stop and frisk was unconstitutional, and ultimately pushed back the power of the biggest gang in New York City, right? We know that the biggest gang in New York City, its color is blue, and it's called the NYPD.
Yes,
so this is definitely an act of retaliation.
Now, you mentioned also at this event that will be taking place that you will also focus on Mumia's lawsuit, Mumia Abu-Jamal, revolutionary political prisoner. And he is suffering from Hep C right now, and there is a cure. I think it has a 90% plus cure rate, and that is being denied to them, and he's going to the courts to sue for access to that medicine. But as I had spoke to other people, I was like, this could have widespread implications across the nation in terms of these prison plantations and access to Hep C medicine or Hep C treatment, because Hep C is pretty much at an epidemic level in prisons, and that is not talked about.
Absolutely. So part of what we see is that men and women who are imprisoned en masse go into the prisons and they become infected with hepatitis C. In Pennsylvania alone, there are approximately 6,000 men who have hepatitis C. Mumia is one of them. And last year in August, Mumia sued the Department of Corrections for its failure to provide proper medical care to treat his hepatitis C. Despite the fact that according to the hearing that was conducted by the judge who heard the case, established that Mumia, like others, is now suffering from the disease in its advanced stages, which essentially means that his liver and his liver function has decreased exponentially. So hepatitis C is a disease, a fatal disease of the liver. Mumia sued. The judge ruled on the suit recently and denied Mumia a preliminary injunction, which would force the prison to treat him immediately. He denied his request for a preliminary injunction on the basis of a technicality, that Mumia and his attorneys had not identified the proper people in the suit. However, the judge ruled in his decision that the Department of Corrections was acting unconstitutionally and engaged in cruel and unusual punishment in not treating Mumia and others. So you are absolutely right. The suit will have widespread impact on Pennsylvania and the DOC, which is going to be forced to treat prisoners with hepatitis C. So we are continuing to challenge the suit, and we are fighting. Part of what we see in the struggle is that without struggle, there is no progress. Everything that we've ever gotten as oppressed people in this nation has come as a result of struggle. I think it's important to mention that there are thousands of people with hepatitis C. I think the number of prisoners with hepatitis C in the nation is 700,000. The danger in that is that prisoners get out of prison and they go into our communities and spread hepatitis C, which is now affecting not just prisoners, but our communities. It is one of the largest and fast-growing epidemics in the nation today, ahead of HIV, AIDS. So this is a real problem that affects prisoners and affects our communities, and this is one of the issues that we're going to be discussing, in part because according to the Pennsylvania Department of Corrections, they will only treat prisoners when prisoners are bleeding from the throat.
Wow.
And this is a detail that made it into the decision of Judge Mariani, who denied Mumia the preliminary injunction, which would get him immediately the care he needs, but he actually outlined the barbarity and medieval character of health care treatment in Pennsylvania prisons. So what we're saying is that this policy, practiced in Pennsylvania, but also across the nation, of treating hepatitis C patients, prisoners, with the curative drug only when they're about to die is absurd. It really is absurd, much like the raid in the Eastchester projects is also absurd and outrageous and would not be allowed in any other community beyond African American and Latino communities across this country. So this is a subject that that we're going to be taking up on this October 5th meeting.
You know, you had mentioned about prisoners coming out with Hep C, which is contagious, and spreading it, you know, to their family and you know, members of the community and whatnot. But I mean, even when you look at it spreading in prison, I mean, when you get sentenced to prison, I don't think that part of the sentence is, you know, Hep C exposure to Hep C, but that's exactly what is going on. And I would think, you know, that I would like to see some class action lawsuits, because this is intentional. This is intentional. How should I say this? This is intentional. They're intentionally in allowing prisoners to get infected with this dangerous, can be fatal disease. And so I'm just blown away by that anybody would even try to defend, you know, giving these men basically a death sentence.
Right, it's premeditated. It really is premeditated mass murder of a whole section of the population, and it's a racialized premeditation, because clearly the people who are most affected are poor African American and Latino people.
Question.
Throughout the prisons.
I have yet to see the CDC weigh in on this. We're talking about a health crisis now. This is a health crisis. We're hearing all about Zika and whatnot, you know, the disease that affects especially newborn babies when the mothers are carrying them and they get bitten by a mosquito with Zika. I mean, they're all over that. But I see this as just as big as a health crisis. But yeah, the CDC, I haven't heard them weigh in on this at all.
Right, absolutely. There is a growing conversation in American society about hepatitis C, in part because it is a greater threat than Zika and HIV/AIDS and all of the other diseases that we're confronting in the society. So hepatitis C in the United States is at the forefront of a dangerous mass widespread epidemic. I think it's important to note that hepatitis C is but one of numerous diseases that are killing prisoners day in and day out. Prisoners, as you know, go into prison at a very young age, but then they get a diet that's high in sodium and very high in carb content, carbohydrates. So prisoners are more likely than the rest of the population to develop high blood pressure and diabetes.
Wow.
And so we have a system that is sickening otherwise healthy people, and also there is another crisis in the prisons of the water. In the prison where Mumia is now housed in Pennsylvania, SCI Mahanoy, and the prison next door, SCI Frackville, there is a crisis with the water. The water smells like feces and is browned. And this has been going on now for approximately a month. And prisoners are getting small amounts of water over the course of the day. They're being asked to eat a lot of fruits. What's fascinating is that the guards have been instructed by the DOC to not drink the water in the facility. So there is clearly a double standard here. There is a crisis. The crisis that we see around lead in the water,
Flint. Flint, Chicago.
Flint, Chicago. We now are hearing that Newark's water source is also quite contaminated. So we have a problem of epic proportion that is ultimately going to come to our doorstep. And it's really time for us to mobilize for ourselves, for our health, and our survival in this society.
I couldn't agree with you more. The last thing that I would like to cover with you, and thank you so much for taking time out of your busy day to speak with us here on Black Talk Radio News. The last thing I would like to cover with you today is also absent from corporate media coverage. Haven't seen CNN, haven't seen Fox, haven't seen MSNBC. None of these national news networks are covering the national prison strikes that have entered into their third week. Launched on the 45th anniversary of the Attica prison strikes that occurred, where prisoners had rose up in rebellion with demands for human rights and to be treated like human beings. And so this national strike, which is across several different states, might be up to about 11 different states from the last update that I had read, and in numerous prisons, and now at the Holman Prisons facility in Alabama, which is participating in the strikes, the guards have also joined in. Some of the guards have joined in the strike and seeing and recognizing that, hey, it's affecting them too and putting them in as much danger as the prisoners. And so they're on strike. What do you know about this strike? People talking about it in your circles?
Well, absolutely. There is a conversation about the strikes in activist circles, but I think this is an important issue that activists who are organized around police violence and police brutality need to pay more attention to.
Yes.
Because there is a direct connection between the expansion of police forces and departments and the militarization of the police over the last 30 years and the growth of the prison industrial complex, right? The cops are the foot soldiers of this expansion of the military of the prison industrial complex. The reason why the media is not picking up on this strike that is now the longest strike by prisoners in U.S. history is because we are living in a complicated period in American history when people are beginning to take the streets and organize in defense of themselves. And historically, the actions of prisoners behind the wall has influenced and inspired and captured the imagination of people outside. And the last thing the government and the people at the top of society want is for there to be a kind of symbiotic protest movement between prisoners and the Black Lives Matter movement, for example. So yes, there has been a complete media blackout on this movement, which is quite advanced politically. Once again, prisoners are challenging Americans to expand the definition of humanity and rights, and they're demanding to be treated as human beings, that imprisonment should not be a death sentence.
They're also pointing out the 13th Amendment did not abolish slavery. Some of those prisoners have actually called in to our station on Wednesday nights. We do New Abolitionist Radio. And years ago when the Free Alabama Movement was launching, some of their organizers would call in to our program that focuses on modern day slavery and human trafficking. So it's been pleasing to me to see the prisoners and those who are holding demonstrations outside the prison using the correct language and calling it prison slavery and pointing to the 13th Amendment. And speaking on the media blackout, to me, there has to be a conspiracy. I have always looked at corporate media as corporate state media that they work with, you know, and I've actually studied, you know, media history, corporate media history, and there have been media executives, like, for example, in the 50s, who said it is their patriotic duty to lie to the American public. And I'm paraphrasing what he said, but that's basically what this man said, is that it's their duty to push whatever propaganda that the United States government wants them to push. And we saw that play out, you know, with the widespread promotion of the lies of the Bush administration about Iraq. And also we saw it again with the lies that were pushed out by the corporate media about what was going on in the on the ground in Libya. So to me, this is something that is intentional on the corporate media's part, in my opinion.
Well, when you have between 4 and 7 large corporations controlling the media in the United States, they're going to act in unison in the interest of ultimately the American ruling class. So you're absolutely right. This is a blackout by design. And in this instance, we have to understand that the prisoners are challenging the entire apparatus of the prison industrial complex, which, by the way, is the third largest employer in the United States. Mm. So the prison industrial complex is the third largest employer in the United States. We know that prisons have pretty much given a new lease on life to small towns.
Yeah, rural areas.
Industrialized rural area. Mm-hmm. That are predominantly white, and you know the guards are predominantly white in prisons across the nation. So, and you have prisoners beginning to challenge the system of imprisonment and its logic at its core, and bringing the issue of slavery, because we know that for a very long time, prisoners have been forced to work at slave wages in all kinds of industries here in the United States, although private prisons, you probably know, have now been determined unconstitutional by the Department of Justice. But the question of prison labor is still a question that hasn't been addressed in American society thoroughly. So it's a shame, but it's up to us to really raise the profile of these strikes. And this is why Black Talk Radio and the alternative press and media are so critical in this period. We have to raise and fund alternative media, Black Talk Radio, as if we were funding our lives, because that is the only source of information that is really raising the issues that affect people at the bottom of society in any systematic way.
Yes, ma'am. We do have a caller 973. Do you have a question for Professor Fernandez?
I do. Hello, can you hear me?
I can hear you.
Yes, we hear
you.
I just want to say I'm so happy that you're on the program today. I call myself Jersey Girl from Jersey. The People's Organization for Progress had Pan Africa and her husband there yesterday, last night, celebrating their anniversary. And she told us everything that you said about the water, about Mumia's position, about the unconstitutional situation with respect to the hepatitis C virus. I mean, a cure not being implemented in the Pennsylvania prison. And she did say there was something coming up on December 11th that they're trying to, rally for Mumia because, you know, she showed some pictures. She took some pictures. She just visited him in prison, and she was very distraught because his condition, you know, when you have that type of disease, it's worse, and his eyes look kind of bluish, and he didn't look, he's a strong man, but he didn't look well at all. And I just love if Mr. Reed can do a soundbite of you talking about Black Radio. It's so critical. That's an awesome soundbite for Black Talk Radio. And I'm just so glad, and you're so right when you say that it is so critical, because there are so many things that we do not hear on the news at all. It's so frightening. It's like I don't even want to turn the news program on. Why should I listen to news if I'm not getting educated? So thank you, and kudos to what you do, and continue what you're doing. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much, sister. I greatly appreciate your comment. On that issue, I think it's important to note that this issue of health care in the prisons is related to the for-profit system of health care that we have. It costs currently in the United States between $84,000 and $90,000 to cure hepatitis C with a pill, a series of pills that are taken daily for approximately 3 months. In India and in Egypt, it costs $300 $300 in India and $2,000, I believe, $300 more or less in India and $2,000 in Egypt to cure the disease. So this, and the reason why it costs so much is because the company essentially convinced the FDA to give it the patent. The patent for the medication, and it set the price at $84,000, between $84,000 and $90,000.
Wow.
So the system of capitalism is profiting from the fatal diseases and the problems of health of not just prisoners, but all Americans.
Yes, ma'am. Yes, ma'am. We have another caller, area code 719. Thank you for calling into Black Talk Radio News. We have Professor Fernandez with us. Do you have a question or comment for us?
Yes, first, good day, Brother Scotty. It's Ramon from 719.
Greetings, Ramon.
Good day, Ms. Fernandez.
Good day.
I wanted to ask, is there any connection between the narrative that men coming out of prison have been having sex and coming home with HIV with what you're talking about? You remember this was a real big narrative, particularly they were trying to use it for Atlanta a while back. Reason why I'm asking that is the narrative was that men was going in there having sex with other men and coming home with these, you know, so-called HIV. Reason why I ask that question is because myself being someone that has been there before, I would start asking the question, is this stuff being passed around in the is there any connection between that narrative and the Hep C outbreak? Does anybody have tied those two together?
Well, absolutely. We are all human beings, and we engage in sexual activity. People who are locked up in prison, it is true, engage in sexual activity of necessity. And Hep C is a sexually transmitted disease. It is acquired through sexual contact and through contact of the membranes of contact membrane to membrane. In the case of Mumia was infected with hepatitis C when he was beaten up by the cops in 1981, shot, and hospitalized, operated on, and transfused. So you can also get hepatitis C from blood transfusions, although after the 1980s, blood that was used for transfusions was checked for hepatitis C. So hepatitis C, when it's acquired through blood transfusions, is something that is a disease that is more likely to be had by the baby boomer generation that didn't have that generation of medical care or the medical care available during that period of time did not check blood banks for hepatitis C. So, in fact, the CDC, in its information and campaign around hepatitis C, asks people who are older than 50 years old to check themselves for hepatitis C, because hepatitis C is dormant for many, 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 many years before it becomes active. It's a chronic disease that becomes active after 20 years or so of being dormant. So this is a problem that is affecting us in all kinds of different ways in our communities.
Did you have any other questions, Ramon?
Well, I think she may have answered a part. Maybe I didn't ask my question, ask it clear enough. I guess what I'm trying to say is, because recently here, an in-law of mine came out of prison and went to the hospital and found out he had Hep C. And this was out of the state of Oklahoma. Now, you know, when those things come up, as you said, first thing comes to people's mind. Now, this is my sister, so I have to be careful about, I had to be very careful. So my concern when I asked her, I said, well, you know, first, naturally, I asked her about his sex life. And, you know, as much as she could confirm, there was no, he wasn't living a second life, I guess, you know, to say, and hadn't even been out long enough to even, if he wanted to, could have. So my question with that is, my point is, he said that he acquired it through a tattoo.
Yes, it can be spread through needles.
Acquire hepatitis C through, there you can acquire hepatitis C through drug use, needles, tattoos,
okay.
Sex, and transfusion. Absolutely.
Okay. Okay. Yeah, you answered my question. Thank you.
Thank you, Ramon. And by the way, I'm working on that. I made a new video to send you about the engineering, so I'll get that to you today.
I know you will. Thanks. Thanks, Scotty.
You're welcome. Right. Thank you for your questions.
But there are plenty of women who have hepatitis C too, by the way. So hepatitis C is transmitted sexually between men and women, and to a lesser extent between women who engage in sexual activity.
Yes, a mother can also pass it on to her unborn child.
And
as well.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Exactly.
Yeah, so it is. It is a very, very, very serious health crisis for not just those in prison, but the entire community, as you know, they are coming back home with this. And it's just a doggone shame that the CDC is not treating this as it should be, treating it as a imminent threat to us. And, you know, I'm seeing all these news reports about Zika, but Hep C and its dangers have been known for a while, and they just acting like it ain't no problem because they're looking at these people as expendable.
Absolutely. It's a health crisis, an epidemic of epic proportion, again, disproportionately affecting communities of color and spread in all kinds of different ways, and there is very little attention. This merits a massive state-sponsored campaign of education, but also a campaign to cure it. Because ultimately, hepatitis C should not be a problem that leads to death or serious liver problems and ultimately liver cancer, because it is curable. The cure is 98% effective, and the only thing that is preventing the state from addressing this problem is the fact that it costs in the United States $84,000 to $90,000 to cure the disease.
Hey, I got an idea. Let's get the Clinton Foundation on it. They seem to have no problem raising large amounts of cash, and they claim that they out here helping people. Let's get them a call and ask them, you know, this is an imminent health crisis for the entire United States. How about, you know, you raising some funds to get these people treatment? I'm being sarcastic, though.
No, absolutely. Absolutely. And in fact, there have been attempts by activists, hepatitis C activists, to force Hillary Clinton to make a statement about hepatitis C and importance.
Really?
Oh, yes, absolutely. There are quite a number of activists who are trying to get reforms passed around hepatitis C and to lower the cost of the medication and to make this a priority of the state.
Yeah, I mean, it's very similar to the EpiPen controversy that we've been hearing about here lately, with the actual drug not costing a whole lot of money whatsoever, but, you know, they're marking it up to where it's just unaffordable for a lot of people. But Professor Fernandez, I don't want to keep you any longer. You have provided us with a lot of great information, and again, expressing the same sentiments as our caller did. I really appreciate the work that you have been doing. I've known about you for some time, since I became aware of and an advocate for our political prisoners. But I tell you, it's just not enough people, not enough organizations who are focusing on our political prisoners. And I really do believe we need something like a South African Truth and Reconciliation Commission here in the United States, especially concerning getting our political prisoners free. Did you have anything in closing that you would like to leave the listeners with, and any contact information or any websites you would like them to visit for more information?
Yes, absolutely. I just want to remind your listeners that we're having this meeting at the National Black Theater in Harlem on Fifth Avenue, just north of 125th Street, at 7 p.m. on Wednesday, October 5th. Immortal Technique will join us, Pam Africa, Bob Boyle, and Niall Ford, who's a young black graduate student and minister. You can visit www.bringmumiahome.com for more information, or you can email us at bringmumiahome.com. And I just want to say that the sister who spoke earlier from POP, the People's Organization for Progress, which is a phenomenal organization that has been holding down the fort in New Jersey, Newark, for many, many years, doing important work around police brutality, Mumia, issues of poverty, you name it. It is true that we are having a big event in Philadelphia in December, likely December 11th. Keep your ears peeled for that. And we always in the Mumia movement do an event close to December 9th, because it was on December 9th, 1981, that Mumia was beaten up by the police, framed and imprisoned for the killing of a white police officer. And so we commemorate and announce that event yearly. And this year we're planning a big event for Mumia, but for all of us, around hepatitis C, around the crisis of hepatitis C in the prisons and in our communities throughout the nation. So thank you very much for the work you do, brother. This is your calling, and it's an important calling that has the potential to raise consciousness around the country, but also bring the information, the vital information we need in our communities for our liberation.
Well, thank you again, and we'll be in touch, and we hope to bring you back on a more frequent basis, because you are a great source of information, and I really, really do respect the work that you do. And you have a great day, and you be safe out there, Professor Fernandez.
Thank you very much. I look forward to being on your show again.
Okay, that concludes our interview with Professor Johanna Fernandez, who is a professor at the City University of New York. The City University of New York. I do want to give another website out. We were, again, speaking about the Bronx 120, the young men who were arrested during the raids in Eastchester in the Bronx in New York. There is a Bronx 120 Commissary and Legal Support Fund. It is on the website youcaring.com in the section for neighbors and community. So if you just do a Google search on Bronx 120, that is the first search that will, the first result that will come up from that search. Also, to get more information about the case, go to bronx120.org. That's bronx120.org. Okay. And but that legal support fund, if you're able, please make a donation as much as you can afford, because they do need competent representation. And I want to speak on something that's related, why it just popped into my mind, but I'm not going to call anybody name out. But on social media yesterday, I kind of had, how could I say this, kind of some very tense words with a person who was demonizing Mr. Scott that was killed in Charlotte. What's his name? Keith Lamont Scott. Apparently, he had a criminal record and had some domestic violence in his past. And so this person took to social media to say he does not deserve our support and what have you, because he did this, that, and the other in his past. And, not even taking into consideration that some of his behavior might have been related to his traumatic brain injury, and that his wife, regardless of any issues they had in the past, was out there in that parking lot begging for his life. Okay. And like Corinne Mack of the Charlotte NAACP said, that She doesn't care to hear about his past, that they always demonize black men when they are shot by police. That's standard operating procedure. So she doesn't care to hear about it, because on the day in question, all he was doing was sitting in his car. And so many will perhaps take that same narrow view and say, oh, these young men, they were gang banging at one time, and you know, we got to get them out the community. They're not worthy of our support and what have you. Again, I would ask that you really think about this in depth. Some of these young men, like, for example, one of them did kill someone, but he did serve his time in prison for that killing. And so what they are doing now is trying to charge other people for that same killing and trying to say, oh, they knew about it, therefore, you know, we're going to hit them with the RICO charges. This is a conspiracy and what have you. This is the misapplication of law, what that law was written for. And it is quite interesting to me that they're using RICO charges to target these young men, often involved in crimes of survival, which I have called it that in the past. And so, but at the same time, like we pointed out in New Abolitionist Radio, when we looked at the Ferguson report from the Department of Justice, the city manager, and as well as the police department, as well as the court, should have been charged with RICO charges. That was a criminal conspiracy. And in that DOJ report on Ferguson, it mentioned violation of criminal statutes. But again, no one was prosecuted. No one was prosecuted. So, there is more to these things sometimes than we might acknowledge. And so I would just ask that you take that view, you know, a misapplication of law, and then trying to punish people for stuff they've already been punished for, and trying to get their life, you know, on the right track. And again, I do believe that was a retaliation by the NYPD slave catchers, because they were had one of their big tools of slave catching taken away from them, and that was stop and frisk. And so this is a retaliation against the entire community who won that battle in the long war against slavery in this country. Let me clear the caller's queue.
Is cleared.
I do want to share a couple of news items of the day, but I'm going to take a station identification break as we miss our breaks. I was kind of discombobulated, got the two different interviews mixed up, and so I just wanted to just do her interview without interruption. So I'm going to take a station identification break, kick some God Life beats from Sincere Naquari, and then we come back. We're going to take a look at the news of the day. I do want, again, read some of those details about this UN panel that says that the United States owes black people reparations, not for slavery, but for racial terrorism. And that terrorism is ongoing. You're listening to Black Talk Radio News. My name is Scotty Reed. I'm broadcasting from behind these enemy lines that I call USA Inc. We'll be right back.
No, I'm not a writer.
Okay.
Give up on my way. Oh, yeah.
Black Talk Radio, since 2008, providing new black media for the masses.
Wouldn't it be crazy? Don't you step for crazy?
Ladies and gentlemen, the President of the United States and Mr. Christian Champagne.
I'ma do my right thing, right here. I'ma make a clear land and DC. Cause I know Obama, y'all will tell my mama, I'm moving east to DC. I'ma do my right thing, right here. I'ma make a clear land and DC. Cause I know Obama, I'ma make some money, mama, you gon' be proud of me.
You have to ask yourself, what is a state? Then you have to take an inventory of every single thing that goes into the making of a state. Let's start with a safety pin.
If you got to buy a safety pin from your former colonial master, then you're a liar when you say you built a state. You're a sham. If you're gonna build a state, then everything that's needed to maintain that state should be ready. You should have trained people to handle your harbor. Your people, not Martin's.
I'ma do my right in front of me. I'ma make a killing in D.C. Cause I know Obama, y'all will tell my mama I'm moving east to D.C. I'ma do my right in front of me. I'ma make a killing in D.C. Cause I know Obama, I'ma make some money. Mama, you gon' be proud of me.
When you don't have all those things functioning for you in your hands, you're an imitation of a state. We have done the wrong thing with our children. Let them have that choice about what to study. You study what we need. A few years ago, when I was in East Germany, a German teacher told me, he said that I know right now how many refrigeration workers I'm gonna need 20 years from now. So I turned to the school and said, turn them out.
I'ma make a killing in D.C. Cause I know Obama, y'all will tell my mama I'm moving east to D.C. I'ma do my right, get my free. I'ma make a killing in D.C. Cause I know Obama, I'ma make some money. Mama, you gon' be proud of me. I'ma do my right, get my free. I'ma make a killing in D.C. Cause I know Obama, y'all will tell my mama I'm moving east to D.C. I'ma do my right, get my free. I'ma make a killing in D.C. Cause I know Obama, I'ma make some money. Mama, you gon' be proud of me.
I'm an avid baseball player and a huge fan of Chicago White Sox.
That's right.
My neighborhood is tough. It isn't always safe. Just recently, I was robbed while walking home from school. But those challenges have not stopped me.
And welcome back to Black Talk Radio News. Scotty Reed in on this broadcast.
To line our children up and say that.
Let me see what's going on there.
That's
Cause I Know Obama featuring Dr. John Henry Clark. That is from the God Life Beats Beat Tape Lectures, Volume 1. Again, the artist is Sincere Naquari. Now, I want to focus on this article right here. I think it is very important. I do remember when the United Nations Working Group of Experts on People of African Descent were here in the United States, a program that is not being broadcast right now. They are on hiatus right now, taking some time off. But Race Treaty, that will come on Friday nights here on Black Talk Radio Network, they covered that extensively. If you want more information, check out their archives on blacktalkradionetwork.com. But the United Nations Working Group of Experts on People of African Descent, and by the way, it is, the UN did declare this the decade for people of African descent. So they were going around different cities in the United States, setting up panels where people were able to come and give information and present evidence of what black people, people of color, non-white people go through in this country. And so this is a part of that. They just came out with this report. I'm on WashingtonPost.com. WashingtonPost.com. It says U.S. owes black people reparations for a history of racial terrorism, says the UN panel. The history of slavery in the United States justifies reparations for African Americans, argues a recent report by a UN-affiliated group based in Geneva. This conclusion was part of a study by the United Nations Working Group of Experts on People of African Descent, a body that reports to the International Organization's High Commissioner on Human Rights. The group of experts, which includes leading human rights lawyers from around the world, presented its findings to the United Nations Human Rights Council on Monday, pointing to the continuing link between present injustices in the dark chapters of American history. In particular, the legacy of colonial history, enslavement, racial subordination and segregation, racial terrorism, and racial inequality in the United States remains a serious challenge, as there has been no real commitment to reparations and to truth and reconciliation for people of African descent, the report stated. Contemporary police killings and the trauma that they create are reminiscent of the past racial terror of lynching. Citing the past year's spate of police officers killing unarmed African-American men, the panel warned against impunity for state violence, which has created, in its words, a human rights crisis that must be addressed as a matter of urgency. So you could go on Washington Post. I also posted this in our new social media community, btrcommunity.com is where you will find Black Talk Radio's Facebook like community. But unlike Facebook, we do not bombard you with advertisers, or we don't data mine your information so that we can figure out who you are, what you like, and what we can sell you and share that information with God knows who. And so, yeah, but you can find this information there in BTR Community. That is BTRCommunity.com. A couple of things here. This is something that I have argued I don't know when I first raised this, but I've had this view for a while, that I've had issues with the reparations movement. Number one issue I had with the reparations movement is that the language that they use would have you believe we are in a post-slavery period. We are not in a post-slavery period. Again, the national prison strikes against prison slavery are ongoing right now. The 13th Amendment clearly states that you can be put into slavery and involuntary servitude as punishment for crime. And then when you target Black, Latino, Native American, and poor white communities, you're practicing slavery. You're practicing slavery when the majority of the people in prison are in there for nonviolent, made-up crimes by politicians, things that people have used. I'm talking about drugs and different natural remedies and what have you. We're talking about cannabis, and you want to lock up people for that, and then you want to deprive them of employment, and then when they commit crimes of survival like selling drugs, then you want to put them in prison for damn near life and what have you. Well, it ain't cause they concerned about nobody doing drugs. It's about keeping the prison plantation full of prison labor. That's what it's about. And so that's the issue I had with the reparations community, and it's because their language does lend to the myth that slavery was abolished in this country. And I made these feelings known to individuals that I know in that movement. But then number two, I know that we are all not the descendants of enslaved Africans. I know that is not how Africans first got on the North American continent or any of this part of the this hemisphere. Whether we're talking about South America, whether we're talking about Central America, whether we're talking about North America, there have always been indigenous black people, African descendant people. The research has already been done. Read a book. Look it up. Okay? And if you read real American history, and, I didn't want to get off topic, but, Sister Professor Hernandez that we just had on, is a professor of history, okay? But I'm an amateur historian, and I read a whole lot. I dig up a whole lot. I really first started, I always have liked history. That was my favorite subject in school. But then, you know, now that we have the internet, I mean, it's like just access to so much information, including the local area that I live in, with North Carolina being one of the original 13 colonies. And so I know that there were free black people during colonial times. Again, you know, when people look, Moors are not separate from black people. Moor just simply means African or black. It's a European a label that they put on Africans, all right? And the Moors at one time was among the ruling families in Europe, okay? The history is there. You just got to look it up. And then some of them came here to the United States. In fact, speaking of Charlotte, Queen Charlotte is said to have been a black woman. I'm talking about Charlotte, North Carolina. It's named after Queen Charlotte. And she's said to be an African descendant person. And so I don't buy that view that we're all descendants of enslaved Africans. Not that you have any shame in that if you are, in fact, a descendant of an enslaved African. But let's not think that that is our identity as a whole. It is not. What we do share is the oppression and the racial terrorism. Again, as I mentioned earlier, you look up the Virginia slave codes, right? When you look up the Virginia slave codes of 1680, I'm not sure, but one of the things that they put in that legislation was to strip black colonists of their Second Amendment rights. In other words, it prohibited black people from owning firearms. And then it also went further to say that a black person could not stand their ground in the face of white terrorism. Like if a white person came up to you and punched you in the face, you could not retaliate. You could not punch them back in the face. You could not knock them the hell out. You will get charged. So I am glad, I am ecstatic to see that this United Nations working group of experts on people of African descent is recognizing the terrorism that faced free black people in this country, going back to colonial times. So that's one of the issues I've had with the reparations movement, is that it's taken too narrow of a view of our plight on this continent. We're all owed reparations for the ongoing terrorism. And I just wanted to keep using that term that Reverend Barber of the North Carolina NAACP said. He called it DOTS, D-O-T-S, Daily Occurrences of Traumatic Stress. So again, we have to use correct language. We are not suffering from any post-traumatic stress disorder. We're suffering from DOTS, Daily Occurrences of Traumatic Stress. So, thought that was a very important article. And now, contrast that with my favorite CEO of USA Inc. And y'all know I'm being sarcastic. I can't wait till January the 20th. And this man is gone from the White House. Just so tired of him. Really. Just, man. If you're not going to do anything to counter racism, you know, man. But this is the issue I have with him. He has done some things to counter racism. While he has done more to uphold the global system of racism and white supremacy, I do have to just tell the truth about it, that there have been certain things that I would view as counter racist. One of those things is allowing the Native Hawaiians to take their country back. It is a lawsuit that is blocking that right now, but through the Interior Department, which is a part of the executive branch, and he is the chief executive officer, he allowed them to hold a vote on whether or not they wanted to continue to be a part of the United States, or if they wanted to reestablish the Kingdom of Hawaii. Okay, I would say that's countering racism. I just read an article the other day. How much money is he about to give indigenous people, Native Americans, reparations? I think something like 500. Is it 500 million or 500 billion? Let me look that up real quick. Let me see. Oh, and I saw that thing where he went to, let me see, Obama, U.S., let me put it like this, United States, to pay Native Americans reparations. Let me see what comes up there. Okay, let's go to the news section. Let's see. Not seeing it there. Let me see. Let me take reparations out. Maybe they're not calling it reparations. Okay, here we go. Why? Here's an article from csmonitor.com. Why the U.S. government will pay Native Americans almost half a billion dollars. So I was right. Almost 500 million, half a billion. The exact amount is $492 million. The Department of Interior and United States Attorney General announced this week that the federal government will pay 17 Native American tribes $492 million, settling claims that the government mismanaged tribal resources for years. This week's settlement is the latest in a series of similar agreements with more than 100 tribes in total as the federal government attempts to chart a new course in tribal relations and dispute resolution. So that, I'll leave it there. There's more to this article. So again, he even said to these Native Americans, and some of them look like $5 Indians, I'm sorry, and I say that as a direct descendant of a Mississippian, a member of the Mississippian Nation, which was the nation that existed here of indigenous people before the colonization of this land. Okay, so yeah, I'm calling you out, $5 Indians, I'm calling you out. So, but I heard him tell them that I hope I've done right by you. I hope I've done right by you. But again, every time he got something to say to black people, he talking down to us. Whether he's going to a college graduation ceremony where black people who have been successful in completing their degrees, and they're bringing him in as the keynote speaker, and what? And he talking down to him. He talking down to him. He's talking down to us. Every time, just like the recent comments he made towards Colin Kaepernick, talking about, you know, we need to consider the pain that you may be causing to military families. Well, look, I speak on that as a veteran of a foreign war, the Gulf War, who thankfully didn't get infected with Gulf War syndrome, okay? But I'll say this, you know, he gonna say that they feeling pain from seeing somebody taking a knee. Get for real. Who the hell are you people whining like little crybabies out there? You should see pain. You should be feeling pain from seeing all these Americans gunned down in the streets of America. Where's your pain over that? Where's your pain over the fact that your relative or whoever it was died while in service to white supremacy? And I keep it in it real, cause that's how I look at my military service. That's what it was. I didn't know it at the time, but that's what it was. Because I guarantee you there will be no troops, not even the National Guard, will be deployed to protect black people from racist terrorism. That has not happened since Reconstruction. Okay, after the Civil War, when federal troops were stationed in the South to protect black people from racist white terrorists And then after Lincoln's assassination, shortly after, they removed the troops, which gave rise to the terrorist organization, the oldest terrorist organization that still exists in this country, the Ku Klux Klan. So there are no military soldiers being deployed to end slavery in this country, to prevent the slave catching of these brutal beasts out there. So, I mean, what the hell? And just a hypocrisy. If you really believe that soldiers are fighting to protect our constitutional rights, then how asinine is it for a person in the military or is a family member of a person in the military to say that, oh, it brings me pain to see somebody take a knee expressing their First Amendment rights against police brutality, raising awareness? You suck. You really do. And I ain't got no sympathy for you. I don't kiss ass. And I'm not going to kiss. Stop kissing veterans' ass. I ain't asking nobody, like I told our guest yesterday, who thanked me for my service. Bro, I just joined for the college money. I ain't joined for no freedom, no liberty to protect all of that, to spread democracy around the world, and none of that. None of that. So again, it's just the pattern and practice of Obama always coming out his mouth the wrong way in reference to the oppression of black people. But when it comes to Hawaiians, when it comes to Native Americans, he's trying to do right by them. What does this man have against us? What does he have against us? Does he hate us or something? I just can't put my finger on it. He's very confusing. On the one hand, he's engaging in trying to right some of America's past wrongs by giving the Hawaiians their country back, by paying these Native Americans for the theft of their resources. But when it comes to us, man, he ain't got nothing but some harsh words. And trying to tell us we need to understand the pain of other people or how they look at things and whatnot. It's crazy, man. I didn't mean to get off on that tangent. But I think that, you know, this is something that we're going to have to continue to fight for. And I just would ask that the reparation movement correct themselves, do a course correction, and start demanding reparations. Not for slavery pre-1865, but for all of it, the ongoing slavery. And we got to demand an end to slavery in this country. You're going to ask for reparations for something that's ongoing, man, and the terrorism is ongoing. So thank you, UN Working Group of Experts on the People of African Descent. Thank you for that. Let me see if there's anything else. Up there in Milwaukee, that's one of the stories we had been covering. They are refusing to release the video again of the killing of the young man who was killed up there. I'm sorry, I can't keep up with all the victims' names. There are just so many. And he's still, the Milwaukee police chief is still refusing to release the video. Again, people in Charlotte, they had to put tremendous pressure. They had to block the financial district of Charlotte. That's where they were, people. Not to reiterate that protest is a tactic, and you may not be looking at everything, but yeah, where they were protesting at was where Bank of America and a whole bunch of other financial institutions were located at. And that's why they got what they wanted, because they, you had them people at Bank of America and these other financial institutions calling the police and saying, damn it, y'all costing us money. We got to get these people off the streets because our employees can't even come to work. Y'all costing us too much money. Release the damn video. All right. So I don't know what y'all can do in Milwaukee. You know, Charlotte's a little bit different, being the second largest banking district in the United States. So, but let's go ahead and listen to this report about the Milwaukee police chief still refusing to release the video of the young black man who was shot and killed, with his family saying that he was licensed to conceal and carry, and that, you know, it doesn't appear that the police are telling the truth, and they got video of it. And if you got nothing to hide, then why not release it? So let's listen to this report. I think this is from one of those students that may be associated with Boyce Watkins. This is from their YouTube channel.
So this story comes to us from Brianna Edwards at The Root. So the Milwaukee Police Chief Ed Flynn announced Thursday that he will not release the video of the fatal police shooting of Seville Smith, giving a nod to the advice of the state's attorney general and local district attorney, the Associated Press reports. According to the report, the State Department of Justice has completed its investigation into the August 13th shooting, sending its findings to Milwaukee County District Attorney John Chisholm to make a charging decision. Wisconsin Attorney General Brad Schimmel has said that the Department of Justice will not release any material until Chisholm makes a decision on charges or rules that the materials can be released. Schimmel had previously acknowledged that two body cameras captured the shooting, about which authorities say the footage clearly shows Smith holding a handgun and turning toward the officer at the time that he was shot. The fatal shooting August 13th prompted two nights of fiery protest in Milwaukee after Smith was gunned down by a black officer following a brief foot chase. Family members have said that Smith knew the shooting officer personally from high school. A source close to the family said that the officer had a personal vendetta against Smith. "He didn't like my brother. The officer had a career, but my brother was more popular. He used to harass Civil," Smith's sister, Sherelle Smith, said. Interesting. They went to high school together and knew each other. A little jealousy might have gone on here. It's sad. All around these police shootings, most of them are not justified. In most of these cases, if not all of them, the person, in my opinion, should still be alive. And so here we have another case where they're refusing to release the video footage, so to speak. So
all right, we'll stop it there. I have posted that video to btrcommunity.com, and I had totally forgot about that. Now, while in Charlotte, there is some question about whether or not the black slave catcher shot and killed Mr. Scott. That's still unclear. It does appear to me that it could have been that uniformed white officer, but what kind of idiot would take the fall for something that he didn't do? Or even though he's claiming he did nothing wrong, if somebody else pulled the trigger, I wouldn't be claiming I pulled the trigger. So that doesn't make sense to me. So it's possible that he did shoot Mr. Scott. I'm talking about the black CMPD slave catcher in Charlotte. And I totally forgot that the slave catcher in Milwaukee was black as well. And let me point this out. First, let me say this. Again, if they don't have anything to hide, then why not release the video, which has been, which is taxpayer funded, that is public property, and the public should have the ability to see it. Okay, the press should be able to get that so they can put it out to the people. And how many times have we heard them say this, that, and the other happened in one of these incidents? And then, you know, the video comes out sometimes years later, like in the case of the St. Louis cop who had his own personal AK-47 that he carried with him on the job. And after they pulled over this motorist who had led them on a chase, was so angry, he said, "I'm going to kill this MF-er." And then jumped out the doggone car with his AK-47 and sprayed the passenger and killed him. They said he didn't do it, that it was nothing wrong. And now this happened in 2011. The video just came out this month, people. 5 years later. And now they're charging that cop with murder. Obviously, I can't give you any concrete numbers, but I'll take a stab at saying that I would venture safely that 50% of the slave catcher killings, or slave catchers killing people, are not justified. 50%, probably higher, but I would say of at least 50% are not justified. How many videos have we seen? Just too many videos have come out. Now, just think about all the videos we haven't seen. But now, getting back to the point of both of these slave catchers being black, I was thinking about this last night. Again, I ain't on here to confront anybody or to call anybody out or antagonize anyone. But in the counter racism circles, if you can't figure out what to do with proxy racists, then I don't know. I don't think any of your efforts are going to be successful if you don't account for the proxy racists. Too many of these proxy racists, including the CEO of USA Inc., all the way down to the slave catcher on your local slave patrol. Something has to be done with them. Now, I know some people in the counter racist circles agree with Mr. Neely Fuller that white people are white supremacists, or I'm saying, let me start over, that white supremacists are the most intelligent people or the smartest people on the planet, is what I heard him say on a clip. Well, if they're so smart in terms of maintaining this system and we're so dumb in terms of we can't seem to overthrow the system and replace it with a system of justice, well, if they are so smart, then maybe I should start adapting some of their tactics. Okay, maybe I should start waging war the same way that they wage war. And how do they deal with people in their ranks that they consider traitors? What do they? How do they deal with them? Or do they just ignore them? No, they don't ignore them. They even got laws on the books like trading with the enemy. I can't think of some of the other, I was thinking about them last night. I just can't think of some of those actual laws on the books. But, you know, espionage, they'll charge you with espionage. They'll charge you with trading with the enemy under the Trading with the Enemy Act. They will put you in prison. They will put you to death for betraying them. They do not tolerate traitors. They really don't. Now, some of them people like Hillary Clinton and them, they can get away with some stuff in terms of putting national security at risk, which really means putting white supremacy at risk, global white supremacy at risk. But the rank and file, you'll find a number of people, rank and file military soldiers and what have you, or people who got caught spying for the Chinese or spying for Israel and whatnot. They just let one of them go. Jonathan Pollard, look him up. White man, practicing Jew, but he's white. And they just actually got him out of prison, and he's in Israel now. But he was in prison for a long time for spying, for betraying the United States government. So in counter racist circles, man, if you it does not make logical sense to ignore any soldier. And they are soldiers. They got the uniform on, don't they? Who's paying them? The state paying them, right? And they out here catching slaves and they killing people. And I didn't know that. I had to look up the statistics again, but I saw some statistics earlier this week that broke down the percentages of who's being killed by who in terms of slave catchers killing citizens. And of course, white men, they killing more than anybody. But these most of the people that these black slave catchers are killing are other black people. See, they know better. They ain't gonna go out here and just shoot up a white boy like that. It might happen from time to time, but very, very rare. But the statistical data shows that they kill other black people the most. So I don't see them as being black. Now, they ain't, to me, you ain't on team black. You on team slave catcher. That's what the team you playing for, and I'm gonna treat you accordingly. I've also heard Mr. Fuller say it ain't about skin color. It's about your actions. Whether you're practicing justice or whether you're engaged in injustice. That's what it's really about. And I agree with that. I agree with that. So, that just came to my mind after realizing that the Milwaukee slave catcher was a quote unquote black man too. And we know from COINTELPRO how they use black people to infiltrate the Black Panther Party, the Nation of Islam, the Civil Rights Movement, that real famous civil rights photographer, FBI spy. Running back telling his FBI case manager everything that he heard Dr. King and the other people discussing. Probably the one that planted the bug in his hotel rooms and what have you. So I'm just looking at this from a military standpoint of view. I'm looking at it from a logical point of view. You cannot ignore any weapon that is being used against you, even if that weapon looks like you. You can't do it. That's why they picked them. It's to confuse you. Don't fall for the confusion. The enemy is not an enemy because of the way he looks. An enemy is the enemy because of what he does. So if you're doing something to harm us, then you are the enemy. I don't care where you go to damn church at. I don't care what your mama and your daddy look like. Because you're looking like a slave catcher to me. So that's how I feel about that. That's why I came up with the term proxy racism, because, you know, people had issues with name calling, and I do agree we should not engage in name calling with people when we're talking to them or whatnot, you know. So I felt like proxy racist was a more scientific sounding term than coon, you know, calling somebody a coon or Sambo. And people misuse the word Uncle Tom. Uncle Tom was the good guy. It was Sambo that was, betraying the other enslaved Africans. Let me see if there's anything else that I want to cover before we get ready to wrap it up. Oh, there is one other thing that I would like to share. And again, this is in relation to people sending me emails about we're not African descendant people. We're not African Americans. I never call myself an African American, but I now no longer say people who call themselves African American are foolish. Okay, they had a reasoning and what have you. So I'm not gonna focus on the little things like that. Okay. But I call myself black, and people told me, oh, you're not black and all this and that. Look, black is a term that black folks chose, okay, in the 60s. And, I came across some information as I was doing some research last night about Steve Biko, the revolutionary anti-racist activist in South Africa who was murdered by police in South Africa, slave catchers in South Africa. But when I started reading about the organization, reading about him, and I noticed he had founded an organization called the Black Conscious Movement, BCM. The Black Conscious Movement was a grassroots anti-apartheid activist movement that emerged in South Africa in the mid-1960s out of the political vacuum created by the jailing and banning of the African National Congress and Pan-Africanist Congress leadership after the Sharpeville Massacre in 1960. The BCM, that again is the Black Consciousness Movement, represented a social movement for political consciousness. Let me read this other part. The Black Consciousness Movement attacked what they saw as traditional white values, especially the condescending values of white people of liberal opinion. They refused to engage white liberal opinion on the pros and cons of Black consciousness and emphasized the rejection of white monopoly on truth as a central tenet of their movement. While this philosophy at first generated disagreement amongst Black anti-apartheid activists within South Africa, it was soon adopted by most as a positive development. As a result, there emerged a greater cohesiveness and solidarity amongst Black groups in general, which in turn brought Black consciousness to the forefront of the anti-apartheid struggle within South Africa. So here you have a Native African, a South African. I don't know what his tribal affiliation was, but here is a African, someone on the continent, calling themselves Black, talking about Black consciousness. And I had never heard this before until we spoke with Missouri State Representative Ellington on New Abolitionist Radio this past Thursday. And I don't even know how the subject came up, but he said that, you know, in terms of African American, that term was brought up to stop people from calling themselves Black, because Black was seen as a universal term used by Black people all over the planet to show or express solidarity and saying, yeah, we're all part of the same struggle, whether you're in the Caribbean, whether you're in on the continent of Africa, whether you're in Europe, whether you're here in the United States, whether you're in Mexico, South America, no matter where you are, this is a way for us to identify with. It's just a term that was brought up to identify us as one, basically. And so whenever these people say, oh, you shouldn't call yourself Black, or you shouldn't say you're African American, or you're a Moor, and then I looked up the definition of Moor and it just simply means Black or African, and I'm like, well, what do y'all want us to call ourselves? What should we call ourselves? Is it cool if I say I'm an Afro-Carolinian? Is that cool? Will people know what I'm talking about when I say I'm an Afro-Carolinian? Because the colony of North Carolina had a lot of free Black people, and it had some enslaved Africans, but had free Black people as well, 5,000 of which joined the Union Army to bring an end to slavery during the Civil War. So is it cool if I call myself an Afro-Carolinian? Would you have a problem with that? Or what if I just call myself a Mississippian, referring to the Mississippian nation of indigenous tribes that existed pre-colonial period? But here is the lunacy that I see in all of it. No matter what Black people have called themselves on this planet, whether they call themselves South Africans, Nigerians, Kenyans, whether they call themselves Black, African American, Afro-Caribbean, whatever, no matter what they've been calling themselves, more, that did not save them from being oppressed and experiencing racial terrorism all over the planet. So the logic just is not there to suggest that part of our reason we're being oppressed is because of what we're calling ourselves. What were them indigenous tribes that got wiped out? I mean, the entire tribe just obliterated, genocided off the face of the planet. What the hell? They knew who they were. They were going by their original tribal names passed down by their ancestors, and it didn't save them. So again, let's not be arguing with each other on silly, foolish stuff that don't mean nothing in terms of Black struggle worldwide. Anyway, just some thoughts I wanted to share as we get ready to shut it down. Tando Radio Show is coming on Stay tuned. Brother Dave, of course, is the host of that program. Tando is on from 6 to 8 o'clock p.m. Eastern Time, and that will conclude our live broadcasting on the station for the night. But, of course, there's always pre-recorded content that's being served up on the station. You can also go to blacktalkradionetwork.com and download any of the media on demand from the various programs on the station. Check out some of the independent stations as well that stream through our platform. And also check out btrcommunity.com. Just a $24 a year subscription. It is a vehicle of not just to provide a safe digital space, another safe digital space for Black people online, but also as a way for us to fund independent Black media in this country. Okay, it is a way for us to fund the building of a mass communications network that'll focus on not just internet radio, but video as well. Okay, so we decided not to make it free, cause you know, really ain't nothing free. You're paying for something, or somebody's paying for it. But like we talk about Facebook, it ain't free. They drilling down all in your private information, in your private messages, data mining you. They say just so they can, you know, show you the right kind of ads and whatnot. But don't think for a minute they ain't been sharing that information with intelligence services and whatnot. We ain't doing none of that. But that's the cost. That's the cost of using their platforms. Okay. So anyway, the reason we have this subscription fee is so that we can not only maintain what we have, but so that we can fund actual brick and mortar media centers everywhere that we can. Going back to what Professor Fernandez said, Black Talk Radio is very important when there is a lack of real information going out to the people, because you got six corporations that are in control of 90% plus of all the media that people in this country see. All right, that's my program. I'm sorry I ran a little over, but Tando Radio Show is coming right up. Stay tuned. Y'all be safe out there over the weekend. It is a battlefield, so you want to have battlefield awareness so that you don't become an easy casualty. Don't let the slave catchers get you either. All right? So y'all be safe out there. Peace and blessings to all.